Claude Monet is perhaps the world's most beloved artist, and among all his creations, the paintings of the water lilies in his garden at Giverny are the most famous. Seeing them in museums around the world, viewers are transported by the power of Monet's brush into a peaceful world of harmonious nature. Monet himself intended them to provide an asylum of peaceful meditation. Yet, as best-selling author Ross King reveals in Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies, the canvases belie the intense frustration Monet experienced at the difficulties of capturing the fugitive effects of light, water, and color. They also conceal the terrible personal torments that Monet suffered in the last dozen years of his life. Again, the name of the book is Mad Enchantment, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ross King to the roundtable this morning. Ross, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
What brought you to this subject of wanting to look at Monet and specifically the painting of the water lilies?
Well, I suppose in some ways, 10 years ago, I did what I might call the prequel to this book, which was a book called The Judgment of Paris, which was about the formation of the Impressionists in the 1860s and 1870s. And Monet appears in it. He's not one of the central characters. It's really about Edouard Manet, his near namesake. But I was really interested in telling the end of the story, because in many ways, we're used to thinking of the Impressionists, and I certainly show this about them in Judgment of Paris. We're used to thinking about them as people who were scorned and derided, especially at the outset of their career. But Monet had a very different ending. If the acclaim for Manet, Cézanne, even Renoir to some extent, was generally posthumous, for Monet, in his own lifetime, really by the time he was 50, he was being celebrated as one of the greatest artists in history. And so he was garlanded with laurels, he had great reviews, he became enormously wealthy, all of which is very interesting because it's quite rare for an artist to gain that acclaim. And yet, the greatest struggle he had was at the end of his life, when he was really at the height of his power. And I was really interested in that kind of dichotomy, I guess, between someone who and the career trajectory, someone who went from derision to fame and yet then had terrible struggles in the period of time that I described, the last dozen years of his life, from 1914 to 26.
As you mentioned, the story does begin in 1914. At this point, he is 73 years old. He has lost his wife and has pretty much retired because he is very wealthy. He is celebrated, and he is also suffering ill health. And so what then begins the process of painting the water lilies?
Well, it's very interesting. His situation is exactly as you describe. He had effectively retired from painting. His wife died in 1911. He began having problems with his eyesight in 1912, what was ultimately diagnosed as cataracts. And his eldest son died at the age of 46 early in 1914. And Monet was a grieving widower. He had health problems. And he really felt he had done everything that he could do, or everything that he'd been able to do. And so he stopped painting. And my story really begins when he's at this low point, but also at the point where he's visited in this dire state by a great friend of his, Georges Clemenceau, who had previously been Prime Minister of France a few years earlier and would be again during the war. And Clemenceau, like many of Monet's friends, and he had many friends, including ones like Clemenceau in high places, they wanted him to get back to his paints and easels, if only because of the fact that they knew that that was what he was born to do, and he was never going to be happy if he wasn't painting. And so Clemenceau sort of innocently said, why don't you do a series of paintings on your water lily pond to decorate a room? And that was really all Monet needed. And by the spring of 1914, he had begun what he, a few months later, began calling the Grande Décoration, his great decoration, which was going to be these acres and acres of canvases of his water lily pond, with which so many of us are familiar. And so he began them when he was in his mid-70s and really painted them and nothing else for the rest of his life. And so he really spent the last decade and more of his very long and very productive life, obsessively painting his water lily garden.
I want to talk about that obsession and talk about the paintings, but let us put it into terms as far as the art world at this point. What was the state of Impressionism? Because things were starting to change at this point.
That's right. And one of Monet's anxieties come 1910, 11, 12 was what the legacy of Impressionism would be in general, and what his legacy would be in particular. Because, of course, the late 19th century, and then especially in the first decade of the 20th century, a new generation of painters had come along. Most conspicuously, in the first decade of the 20th century, people like the Fauves, led by Henri Matisse, who initially had worshipped Monet in the 1890s. He thought Monet was world's greatest painter, and then he really repudiated him and began painting in a somewhat different style, trying to get out from under Monet's influence. The other great figure, of course, was Pablo Picasso, another young painter who, unlike Matisse, was painting in a very different style and coming out of a different kind of tradition than Impressionism. And so I think Monet knew that his reputation, he was at risk. By 1905, when virtually everyone except Degas, Cézanne, Monet and Renoir, the Impressionists, had died. People were saying that Impressionism as a movement was dead. It had been superseded. And I think Monet was aware that he had, during his lifetime, he had enjoyed enormous success, really from the late 1880s on. And the price of that, possibly, was going to be, derision and obscurity in the hereafter. And I think he was very worried that his legacy would not stand the test of time. And part of the Water Lilies project, I think, was trying to carve himself a kind of niche in history, or really create a hostage to fortune with these very, very ambitious paintings.
As I was reading the book, I was fascinated by this question, and it's a chicken or the egg question, which is, you write about how he was seized by this terrible anxiety and depression. Did that come as a result of this concern about legacy, or was it cumulative as to everything else that was going on in his life and it was one more thing for him to obsess about?
I think it was the latter, but I think having said that it was this, it was part of a cumulative effect. Monet was always, even as a young man, he was very anxious. A friend of his said he was a perpetual worrier, forever anguished. And what made him more anguished than anything else was his painting. When we look at his paintings, we want to stroll into them because he has the beautiful meadow, the poppy field meadows, the beautiful scenes of the River Seine, of the cliffs of Normandy, etc. They're really picture postcard visions of the French countryside that all of us would like to enter into. And I think we would imagine that they were painted by someone who was at peace with nature and also at peace with himself, but not a bit of it. Monet was raged before the canvas. He was obsessed with painting. He almost could not stop painting for much of his life. It was an absolute obsession that he had. And yet it also tortured him. Again and again, he wrote, painting is a torture to me. And it was a torture because his reach always exceeded his grasp. He was trying to do things that it was really impossible for a painter to do. He was trying to paint light, color, clouds, reflections, all of these intangibles that were forever changing. He was trying to freeze them in pigment on canvas, to take a split second a kind of snapshot of something that was forever changing and capture it in that moment of transition. And that really was a recipe for artistic frustration, and therefore, in his case, a kind of mental disaster, and that the sort of exasperation that he suffered for much of his career, and in particular, when he sat beside what a friend called the luminous abyss of the water lily pond, and he sat staring at it day after day, week after week, and ultimately year after year, trying to fix in his mind and then on his canvas, the way the light changed, the way the clouds were reflected, the look of the water lilies at different, in different seasons and different times of the day. So he really set himself this absolutely impossible task, and then raged at himself and tore up canvases and stabbed canvases and stamped on them, put his foot through them, when he wasn't able to live up to his own extremely high expectations.
Ross King is our guest. The name of the book is Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. So with each painting, was he trying to outdo the one before? They weren't looking at different subjects as much as he was trying to improve on different aspects of the painting?
That's right. In some ways, he was in competition with himself, because I think like any great artist, he was always trying to do something better than he had done before. But in many ways, what he was trying to do, especially with the water lily paintings, was to create paintings that spoke to each other, which is why he wanted them, many of them, to be shown permanently together, because they had a relationship with one another. You could see what his garden looked like at dawn. You could see what it looked like at dusk. And he would sort of take you through the day, through the changing hours of the day, the changes in light, the changes in wind, and ultimately through the changing seasons as well. But it was a competitive character in a way, and he wasn't just competing with himself and his previous works. He was also competing with other painters. And so, for example, in the book I describe somewhat briefly, because it's before the action of the book, when he went to London around the turn of the 20th century, and he went there because he was competing with the great English painter J.M.W. Turner. And when he painted his beautiful vaporous scenes of the River Seine near his house in the 1890s, he was competing with the man that he thought was the greatest of all French landscape painters, Camille Corot. And so in some ways, his suites of paintings, these series of beautiful paintings that he did, where he would paint the same motif again and again and again at different times of the day and in different seasons, were ways of challenging the achievements of other painters and trying to show that Claude Monet is top dog and he's the one who can outpaint anyone. And once again, it sort of shows his vaulting ambitions and his attempt to really inscribe himself indelibly into art history.
You mentioned a moment ago that this story really starts in 1914. There is an image in the book of a painting entitled Water Lilies by Monet that dates to 1908. It is striking for two reasons. One is because it's so different than the other paintings, but it also shows that this was a subject that he was interested in prior to 1914.
That's right. Just a bit of chronology. He moved to Giverny in 1883 when he was 43 years old. He was renting at first. 7 years later, when he earned a lot of money, he bought it in 1890. 1893, he began his water lily garden, and it reached its definitive form in about 1902 or 1903. And that's the point, in about 1903, that he first began painting it. And he painted it on smallish canvases, about 2.5, 3 feet wide by 3 feet high. And he painted, he began about 150 canvases of the water lily garden between 1903 and 1908. He ripped up, destroyed, painted over half of them. And of those, 48 were shown at an exhibition in Paris in 1909, which was really a kind of highlight of his career, because all of those paintings were sold. They got tremendous reviews where people said, he's not just the greatest painter in France, he's the greatest painter of all time. And yet, as I describe in the book, the great irony of that is no suite of paintings had ever given him as much difficulty as those ones that he painted 1903 to 1908. And so, just because of the carnage, I mean, the torn canvases, the ripped up canvases, right, the bonfires that he had of them, exceeded anything he had done previously. And so a number of years later, Clemenceau, as I was describing, told him, it's time to buck yourself up and begin painting your water lily pond. That was a risky strategy because, as I say, no set of paintings had ever given him such difficulties. And so what I found fascinating from a kind of narrative point of view is the the sort of courage and maybe almost foolhardiness of Monet in 1914 to begin painting this motif again on a much larger scale when he had lost 3 years earlier the calming influence of his wife, Alice. And so it, in some ways, was tempting fate for him to once again sit beside his water lily pond, stare into that luminous abyss and try to reproduce on canvas what he saw with his, what were by then eyes that were beginning to fail. And so I think it was that dynamic I was very interested in, the fact that he goes one last time down to that waterhole, that stares at it and sees what he can finally take away, what legacy he's going to take away from his pond for posterity and for the betterment and the furtherance of his reputation.
So you mentioned 150-some paintings prior to 1908. As he begins in 1914, where the action of the book is, how many water lily paintings do, of that time, how many do we...
If we only count from 1914 onward and only look at the ones that survive today, and so ignore the ones that perhaps have been lost, that are unaccounted for, and the ones that he destroyed, because there were many bonfires between 1914 and 1926, and many ripped canvases, many temper tantrums, and things like that. What he produced really is astounding. He produced about 60 or 70 large-scale studies, which he painted by the side of his pond. And when I say large-scale, they were about 6 feet high, six and a half feet high by 5 or 6 feet wide. So very large paintings to do outside. Usually if you're painting en plein air, you paint something that's maybe 2 feet high by 3 feet wide. So he was working on canvases by the side of his pond that were larger than any he had worked on for many decades. But that wasn't even the half of it. The most remarkable thing are these paintings that he called the Grand Décoration, which it's anyone's guess how many ultimately he painted. Some estimates are 50. Of the ones that survived today, there are 41. There were 42 until the late 1950s when one was burned at a fire at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. 42 really was his legacy that that were accounted for when he died in 1946, but there were probably others as well. And when this was the great decoration, the grand decoration, and they were large paintings. And anyone who's been to MoMA or who's been to the Nelson Atkins or who's been to the Carnegie in Pittsburgh knows how large these paintings are. Many of them are 20 feet across. At MoMA, there is the enormous one that's over 40 feet across. And so he was really painting acres and acres of canvas, 40 feet across by over 6 feet high. So these were enormous canvases. And as I say, he possibly painted over 50 of them. When I say canvases, many of them were triptychs. So they're these large-scale compositions. So he was really, in those last 12 years of his life, with failing eyesight and the advances of age, and also with all of his grief and also with the logistical difficulties of painting during the war, he produced an incredible amount. I think there's almost no other artist we can point to who was so productive and also so innovative while he was working in his 70s and 80s. And so it really was a kind of remarkable late life blooming for Monet, that someone who already by 1914, when he thought he was retiring, had achieved something that certainly would have put him into the history books. And yet after that, he went on to produce what I think many people today would now say is his greatest achievement. And just in terms of sheer volume, it's astounding what he did. When friends came to Giverny to see what he had done, they let their jaws drop. They left dumbstruck. Even painters like Bonnard, a friend of his who did large-scale paintings, he said this is the work of a colossus, which is an interesting comment considering Monet was a very short man. And yet this little man had somehow magically conjured out of his own sort of physical decrepitude, because he really was quite unwell towards the end of it, and with his failing eyesight, these absolutely remarkable paintings.
I asked the question earlier about was he trying to improve with each painting? And you said that there was a sense of competing with himself. Given his age and given the poor eyesight, was he ever able to, is there any record that he was able to appreciate what he accomplished, appreciate that body of work?
That's a very good question, and I wish I could say yes. I wish for Monet's sake I could say yes, but he never seemed to be satisfied with what he did. He once said that, I've done all I can do, I've fallen short, and he was really sort of admitting failure. This was when he was about 70 years old. And this is a wonderful quote that he gave to Georges Clemenceau, his friend, towards the end of his life. And he said, "When I am dead, I'll be able to bear their imperfections." And he thought all of his works had imperfections. And as I say, his reach always exceeded his grasp. And it would have been nice, I think, for Monet and for us, I think, looking back at him, to know that he felt at the end of his life he had made his mark adequately. But maybe like all great artists, he was never willing to rest. He sought a perfection that was impossible. Interestingly enough, what he thought in some ways was his greatest legacy was not his painting, but his garden. I think he believed that he had possibly achieved perfection with his garden. And if painting drove him crazy, or if he drove himself crazy as he painted, he seems to have had nothing but pleasure and enjoyment from his garden. And so I think it was, you know, he would wake up in the morning and look out of his bedroom window at his garden. It would be the last thing he saw before he went to bed. And I think that was what almost gave him more of a sense of achievement and certainly more pleasure than all of the canvases that he was producing. I think Claude Monet, if he marked his own report card, he would have said, "could do better," which is really a remarkable way of judging himself, to have that kind of unrelenting self-scrutiny.
And talk a little bit about the garden today and its state and still its inspiration for beauty.
Yes, we're very fortunate to have it because it's really only in the last generation or so that it's been brought back the way it was in Monet's time, because he died in 1926 and his beloved daughter-in-law/stepdaughter, Blanche, lived there for a number of years, and then she moved to the south of France, and it really fell into ruin. And visitors who went there in the 1950s describe both the studio being a bit of a wreck and many of the paintings in it being neglected, and also the garden being somewhat derelict, despite the fact that it was one of the most famous gardens in France. And we have to thank a lot of Americans, including people like Helen Boardman, for bringing it back. There was really a movement in the 1970s to restore it to its former grandeur. And anyone who's been there, in the last 25, 30 years or so, knows just how spectacular it is. And you know, everywhere you turn, you do see a sort of a Claude Monet vista. And I think no one now can look at any kind of water lily pond, any water lily blooming on a pond, without thinking of Monet. But more especially, you cannot be at Giverny without somehow feeling that you're communing with the spirit of Claude Monet.
Well, the name of the book is Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. The book is published by Bloomsbury. Ross King, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet and the Painting of the Water Lilies. It is published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.